For me, conferences like Marxism are really precious in two ways, right? In one way, this is a conference that is about radical ideas, ideas that we need to change the world, the kind of clarity that we need to change the world, debates on the left that matter for what we do next. But the other thing that's very precious for me about a conference like Marxism is it's a chance to gather together with other people who also want to commit themselves to trying to change that world. It's a recognition that ideas mean nothing without organization, without activity, without campaigns, without the self-conscious intervention of masses of people into history. And Said matters, I think, particularly in that aspect of the conference for the kind of inspiration he gives us, for the inspiration he gives us as people who want to transform the world consciously, who don't want to accept the logic of the system in which we've been placed under, and who are seeking from one another in conferences like this an emotional, or I might even say a spiritual sustenance that gives these ideas a reality and an actuality when they're put into practice in the organizing of process and the refusal to give up and the refusal to see the logic of the system as endless. Said's a very curious figure for us in this sense, because what drew him to that moment of opposition is not the run-of-the-mill things, right? His life confirms a number of basic Marxist claims about the ways in which ideas are caught up in the social whole, and yet in quite an extraordinarily unusual sense. He was born into quite considerable wealth, right? He was born into a very wealthy family. His father was involved in a business, a stationery business, right? In 1935, that gave stationery, you know, pencils and letterhead and things like this to government departments in Egypt and elsewhere. And if you think about in those days, that's kind of the equivalent of running the internet or the electricity for government departments, right? It's a really significant money. And was brought up in a series of private schools, boarding school, elite US universities, until by the time that he was coming to the end of the sort of the period of youth in his life, when he was in his early 30s, he was teaching at Columbia University in the United States and had a very easy, very comfortable career ahead of him. And something happens in that period, 1967, right? The war in 1967, the extension of the Zionist colonial project, the setback, as it's described in Arabic, that had a kind of shattering impact on Said, had a shattering impact on the life that he had led, and forced him to make a choice about how he was going to be organized, how he was going to organize his life. The 1967 war, in Said's words, I'll quote it, shifted him from, quote, from being an exile to becoming a Palestinian once again, from a political living death to vitality and a revitalization of thought. A whole range of Palestinian speech has erupted. What happens in 1967, obviously, in military terms, a very successful conflict for the state of Israel, right? The expansion of the boundaries of the state of Israel, right? Occupation of further Palestinian land, the sort of growth and confidence of the ability of Israel to operate as the kind of the attack dog of the United States in the Middle East, had a shattering consequence that was in a way a liberation for Said, because it forced him to take sides. Yeah, it forced him to take sides. In other words, he'd been living this life as a literary critic and an academic at Columbia University. He'd been writing about works of modernism, works of literature, teaching, raising a family, doing all these sorts of things. And then he found himself in a world where he had imagined himself as being accepted, where every single person cheered the victory of Israel, where the very existence of the Palestinians as a people was in dispute, or in fact, in pretty deep denial. And Said had to make a choice at that moment. Am I going to stand against this? It was a very uncomfortable choice to make, right? He was the only person at Columbia University, apart from the president of the university, who had a panic button in his room, right? They had to fit out his office with security gear, right? Because there was legitimate concerns that people would try to assassinate him. He endured decades of vilification in the American press. There were articles published trying to dispute his family history, trying to claim that he'd faked his Palestinian identity and so on and so forth. And yet through all of it, Saeed stuck to the project of Palestinian liberation. So the first reason to ever talk about him at a conference like Marxism 2021, I just think is the inspiration of considering a life that commits itself to politics. Not a life that commits itself to Marxism, not a life that commits itself to socialism, not a life that in its shape has a whole lot that most of us can recognize, right? You know, in terms of the sort of the level of wealth that lifts you out of the ordinary sphere. And yet that fundamental point, sometimes you have to make a choice, sometimes you have to take a side, I think is something that can guide us here. The second moment in his life that I think is of interest for us as well is if we fast forward about 25 years, 25, 26 years, from 1967 and the kind of political awakening that occurs in, say, his decision to make the name Palestine known in the United States, to 1993 and the Oslo Accords. Saeed had been the best known advocate of the Palestinian people outside of the Middle East, certainly the best known English speaking advocate of the Palestinian people through the 1970s and 1980s, and had sat on the National Committee of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. In 1993, then with the Oslo Accords and with the move from the PLO and the Fatah leadership around Arafat, around Abu Amr, to recognize the state of Israel and to have a kind of Bantustan fictional state carved out on the west bank of the Jordan River, being presented as a breakthrough and being presented as a victory, there was enormous pressure on supporters of the Palestinian struggle internationally to trim their sails. You know, to see this as a kind of new realistic breakthrough in the face of the defeats and the setbacks that the Palestinians had experienced, or the leadership of the Palestinian movement had experienced, I should say, since the downturn of the First Intifada. Had Saeed chosen to go along with that, he would have received a rapturous welcome in the halls of power. He was rung up and invited to the White House by Clinton staffers to be part of the kind of theater that was the signing of the Oslo Accords, right, where Arafat was brought in and there was the handshake and the Nobel Prizes and all the rest, right? Had Saeed gone along with that, he would have, and he, I should point out by this stage, was a man in his 50s, close to 60, living with leukemia, right? So not a well man at all, tired, physically tired. He would have received a welcome into the world of the liberal media, you know, the kind of the conference circuit, all these sorts of things that had frozen him out up until that point. His response was to denounce the Oslo Accords, to denounce the leadership of the Palestinian Liberation Organization for failing to triumph, for failing to fight for the liberation of Palestine, and with great scorn to describe the event. And I quote, "There was Clinton, like a Roman emperor, bringing two vassal kings to his imperial court and making them shake hands in front of him." In response to that criticism, Saeed's works were banned in territories controlled by the Palestinian Authority through the 1990s, through to his death in 2003. You couldn't purchase them in areas under the PA. 30 years on from the Oslo Accords, we've seen every criticism Saeed made of that capitulation borne out. The strategy of Fatah on its own terms, not even on our terms, right, on its own terms, has been exposed as an abject failure. And so I think those are two reasons to take Saeed seriously, to celebrate him and to read him in context. There's a beautiful line I want to read from a poem by Mahmoud Darwish that he wrote in 2003 when Saeed died. And Darwish in this poem kind of imagines a dream conversation between him and Saeed when Saeed's gone back to Jerusalem, where he's from, where his family's from, and he'd stood outside his family house and seen the settler family inside it and imagined, could I have a conversation with these people? And Darwish Saeed says, "Would they ask, who is that prying foreign visitor? And how could I talk about war and peace among the victims and the victims' victims without additions, without an interjection? And would they tell me there's no place for two dreams in one bedroom?" Now, what Saeed insisted on all through his life is that the answer to this question, there is no place for two dreams in one bedroom, was always to say there's one dream. Yeah, that the liberation of the Palestinian people is a universalist project. Yeah, it's a democratic project. It has to be, or it will be nothing. The liberation of Palestine is impossible without imagining it in those terms. What that meant in terms of state form, he shifted his answers to around his life, right? From in the early 1970s being one of the first proponents of the so-called two-state solution, by 1999, he was arguing for a single democratic, secular state of Palestine for all of those who live in it. And so tracing him, I think, is a really useful thing for us to do. It's been 18 years now since Saeed died. And so I think there's a useful opportunity for us here to put him in perspective and ask, what does his writing offer us today? What kind of contribution does Saeed's writing still make to the struggle for Palestine and also to the struggle for socialism? I think Saeed's political humanism gives us something in the light of revolution and counter-revolution in the Middle East. Saeed's Palestinian identity was for him, like I said a minute ago, always a key to the universal, always connected with the democratic emancipatory politics. To read Saeed is to be immersed in the experience of Palestinians from below. Yeah, so he traced out the voices, the images, the words of people living in historic Palestine, living in the refugee camps around historic Palestine, or like him, living in exile in the West. In doing so, he earned the animosity not only of apologists for Israeli violence in the West and in the Western Academy, but also the animosity of those running the oppressive capitalist regimes in the Middle East itself. In the mid-1980s, he coordinated, it's very beautiful, I recommend that you look it up, it's published as a book called After the Last Sky, a series of photographs of people living in historic Palestine alongside text by Saeed. Saeed, of course, couldn't go in. He couldn't access historic Palestine himself. The photographer was a European photographer. And this was going to be shown in the United Nations in Geneva. And yet a number of ruling classes in the Middle East, or their ambassadors, objected to this because, of course, for them, Palestine was useful as a bargaining chit on the diplomatic circuit, but the lives of actual Palestinians involved in organizing for themselves represented quite a threat. Saeed's worth reading for us, I think, to remind us that anti-imperialism, as we seek to practice it, is about forging connections from below against imperialist forces. It's not about choosing between rival power blocks. Saeed had a quite aristocratic contempt, I think, actually, for the sort of politics that imagines human liberation being to do with setting things up on a ledger, considering which states were against the United States and therefore putting a plus where a minus might have been. Saeed's academic legacy, I think, is also worth us thinking about a little bit here today. There's a contest going on. You know, he's a figure who was widely reviled by the forces of power in his time, who's now being rehabilitated and turned into a kind of liberal icon. The New York Times, which was consistently hostile to Saeed through his life because of his advocacy of Palestinian freedom, ran a review of a biography that's just come out of his life a couple of weeks ago. And the headline described it as a quote-unquote interesting life, which I think is just one of these ways you can say nothing, or you can say everything by saying nothing. And the review gave more time over to his personal life and his sexual life and so on than decades of struggle for Palestine. So we need to reclaim those aspects of Saeed that are uncomfortable, that are against the forces that be. I want to give some second thoughts as well. So I was due to give this talk in 2020 and, well, life intervenes, you know, a global pandemic intervened. And I want to think about some ideas that I would have presented then in terms of some of the debates that have emerged on the left in the face of the defeats of the Sanders campaign and the Corbyn project in Britain, and kind of reclaiming the necessity of a core revolutionary politics there, and some of the ways in which we might think about our universalism and theirs when it comes to the re-emergence of a kind of left reformism internationally. I don't have a lot to say about Orientalism, the text. There's a very good article in 2019 in Marxist Left Review on, I've got the title, it's just called Marxism and Postcolonial Theory, that a comrade wrote that draws on critiques of Said in a wider context there. And so if comrades are wanting to immerse themselves in that argument, I'd just recommend that article. I thought I don't really have anything more to say that's not in there. So I'll just point to that. Okay. I think there's something we want to do here as well around, can I just pause to ask an editorial question? Ben, are you going to give me notes of how long I've taken, or is there not an electronic way of doing that?
Would you like that?
Yeah, I would. I would like that very much.
17. Oh, can you see me?
Yeah, I can see you. Yep. So you can hold them up. Brilliant. Great. So I think there's also an important Australian context here, right? Whereby what we're doing is facing now not just the generation of the so-called war on terror, but over 30 years of bipartisan Islamophobic racist rhetoric from both major parties, from Labor and from the Liberals, that has normalized a kind of brutality and a brutalization in Australian politics that Said offers us something to think through. Comrades in Sydney, older comrades in Sydney may well remember following the tragic murder of Edward Lee in Punchbowl, the way the Carr state government used that to ramp up a whole kind of war on crime rhetoric around Lebanese Australians in Canterbury Bankstown, the rhetoric around the Tampa election and so on, the sort of progressive dehumanizing of Muslims being something that's been stitched into Australian mainstream politics now for a long time. I don't know if it was covered in the media in Australia. It was certainly an issue here that Peter Dutton actually allowed a reporter from Channel 9 access to the tarmac of people who were being deported to New Zealand, people who had never lived in New Zealand, who were being deported under these 501 deportations, and had them sort of mocked and made fun of in the journalist provoking responses, right? So there's something here that Said, I think, matters around. Said stands against that, I think, with his insistence on the Palestinian right to narrate. Said was one of the first writers to put Palestinian voices, lived experience, right at the center of his journalism, of his books, of his critical works. And I think we could see ourselves as continuing in that legacy in the way in which campaigns such as boycott, divestment, and sanctions, the protest movements on the campuses, the emphasis on self-activity have kind of broken the logjam politically that existed through the 1980s and 1990s, where a whole lot of the forces in Palestine solidarity campaigning saw themselves as attached to either different power blocks inside the Palestinian movement or in the region more generally. I said earlier I wanted to think about Said as a writer and an intellectual activist rather than a theorist or a sense of someone who's founding a school. And I think part of the reason for this is that Said is at his best in his shortest pieces, in his journalistic interventions, and in his responses to particular moments. That's where we can get the most inspirational kind of work. As a broader thinker, I think we have to say Said's engagement with Marxism and with political economy in general, actually, was fleeting and could be very superficial. When Orientalism came out, for instance, there were very substantial responses from Sadiq Jalal al-Azim and Ijaz Ahmad, and Said simply never responded to them. Said deployed Marxist figures in his work, Gramsci and Lukács most importantly, but in a totally kind of magpie way, just picked details from them. The sections on Marx's writing in Orientalism are sloppy and are often plain wrong. And I'd recommend comrades see the writings of Pranav Jani on that and Kevin B. Anderson's book, Marx at the Margins. If you have copies of this at the bookstore, it's an absolutely fantastic text, sort of going through in detail what Marx actually wrote and the way that he was influenced by the anti-colonial struggle. So I don't think it's very interesting to say that Said wasn't a Marxist and never claimed to be. I think we should ask ourselves instead, what can we learn from this legacy? So I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, the first point I think we can learn from his legacy is this insistence on the right to narrate, centering the Palestinian struggle in the everyday experience of Palestinians in historic Palestine and in exile. Said was one of the key figures, I'd suggest, in translating those lessons from the mass movement, from the resistance of Palestinians, into a really crucial linguistic shift where in the 1970s, you would almost never read the word Palestine. You'd almost never see the term Palestinians. It was always Arab, this kind of generalizing term that was used to try and deny the existence of the Palestinians. Side was absolutely central to overcoming that and to insisting on the reality of Palestine, the reality of Palestinians, the reality of Palestinian struggle. The Question of Palestine, his 1979 text, struggled to find a publisher in the West for that very reason. And he had, by this stage, a very distinguished academic career, had published all sorts of books in literary theory and literary criticism, and yet this work of interventionist journalism, he had to sort of ship around many publishers to try and find. He also had problems trying to get versions out in the Middle East. Beirut publisher offered to publish it only if he cut his criticisms of the regimes in Syria and Saudi Arabia, and Said refused. This, I think, was also Said's approach to literature, and this is another reason why I think he matters for us. I think Said is relevant to revisit in the era of the Ramsey Center for Western Civilization. I have to confess something to the conference here. It was an extremely embarrassing experience. I was doing research for this talk, and I forgot to put my microphones on, and I was listening to a video of Tony Abbott in conversation with Kim Beazley, but I was at work, and so a student came in and could hear this thing. I was trying to explain, you know, there's a perfectly reasonable explanation why someone would be watching Tony Abbott on a video, but I think it matters. Abbott, in November 2020, this is a video on the Ramsey Center's website, says, and I quote, "The pinnacle of human achievement thus far are the Western countries. The Western countries are the greatest human creation yet." And to back him up, an equally loathsome and odious figure, Kim Beazley, who was a leader, federal leader of the Labour Party in the 2000s, nodded and said, yes, Tony's right about that. But he added that, quote, "Identity politics and particularism threaten democracy, as does the attack on the selfless internationalist project that the United States and others carried out after the Second World War." I think Beazley's comments are particularly relevant for thinking about Said because they point us away from, or they point us towards a kind of reconstruction of imperialism after the Trump era. Yeah, the idea that there was something selfless and world-building about the idea of America and the idea of the American empire. The Ramsey Center state as their mission, valuing the richness, diversity, and complexity of over 3,000 years of cultural and societal development to nurture a better informed, wiser, and more civic-minded society. Just felt a little bit sick. What Said gives us here, I think, is a really useful insistence on where that kind of rhetoric came from. Yeah, it's not enough just to say, as smaller liberals can and as humanists can, oh, there's this other rich human culture. We need to understand all these other things in the world. Of course we need to do that, right? But that's not the conversation we're having. The conversation we're having is, to what end are these rich legacies being deployed? Yeah, what are they excusing? What are they covering up? Who are they making invisible? What are they making inaudible? What kinds of interventions by people like Abbott do they serve to cover up or to justify? This is a question of curricula, but it's also a question of politics. What work is culture doing there? I think Said's relevance to this. Said counters that with what he sees as the role of the critic. And this is where I'm sort of moving into the last part of my talk. I think there's tensions that we might want to draw out, or there's ways in which our politics differ quite significantly to his. Said saw his mission like this, and I'll quote. It's from the World, the Text, and the Critic. He says, "Criticism must think of itself as life-enhancing and constitutively opposed to every form of tyranny, domination, and abuse. Its social goals are non-coercive knowledge produced in the interests of human freedom." So against the Ramsey Center's idea that the Western civilization's this thousand-year-old project that becomes the pinnacle, he's saying actually the job of the critic is to enhance democratic freedom, democratic possibility. What do we do when we read literature to find those possibilities? I think that's very admirable. Thanks, Ben. I think that's very admirable, but I think also we've got to be pretty critical of it, right? That's where our materialism has to come into play. Said says this should be the role of the critic, right? But we have to ask ourselves why and to what end? What drives people to make these kinds of choices? And I don't think, as he sometimes seems to suggest, immersion in literature is going to cut it as a reason. Yeah, the individual, the kind of the towering figure outside of the political realm who can intervene as the intellectual. We have a few examples in history of people do that, but they mean nothing outside of a movement, either to push them in that direction or to gain insights from them. let's think about Said then in the context at the moment of one of the biggest assaults on public tertiary education and the humanities in particular in Australia. I think it's very striking, and there'll be comrades in the audience who know much more about this than me from their involvement in that campaign. But I think it's very striking that over the past year, there's been very little correspondence between people's so-called theoretical positions, often quite left-sounding theoretical positions, and their actual positions on the ground in terms of the struggle to save jobs and to save positions at universities. What's mattered much more is their class positions. Yeah, being a manager, no matter how radical your theoretical work, puts you in a managerial position. Comrades in Sydney might think of the example of Anne-Marie Jagos, globally famous as a kind of radical theorist in queer theory, but initiating restructuring at the University of Sydney, acting like a dean, like a job cotter, and the kind that we see elsewhere. So Said's idealist talk about the role of the critic is admirable when it comes to his own life and to the risks that he took in his own life, but it offers us little guide as to why people are taking positions that they take now and how we defend this humanistic legacy, what kind of spaces exist there. Said's liberalism is very vague on the role of universities. He once called them the last places where you could find utopia, which I think is one way to look at things if you've got a tenured position at Columbia University, quite a different one if you're on the casualized mill of teaching, marking, and studying in debt. That is the reality maybe for more people in the audience here. Another point I'd raise, I think, in terms of what we do with this legacy is Said is an extraordinary writer on culture, on reclaiming culture, as I've stressed, on reclaiming the voices of Palestinian experience, translating that into the language of Western media and academy, an extraordinary reader of so-called Western culture. And yet this also leads, I'd suggest, to inflate the role of culture in political struggle and often to fudge important distinctions. In Said, the terms power, empire, and intellectual are all used in ways that seem central but are vague. What does it mean to serve power or be against power? Whose power? You know, to what ends? What is empire? If we're talking about empire, are we talking about the formal colonialist project? Are we talking about imperialism and inter-imperialist rivalries? What roles do these terms play in his work? This vagueness, I think, can lead Said to flattening out the struggle around culture, right, as an Orientalism, where he very much downplays dissident and dissenting cultures inside the working class movement in Britain against colonialism. And it also matters to his way of building the argument to minimize it, right, where he tries to build these sort of all-encompassing terms. By way of contrast, I think those of us who are socialists in this setting would say looking at examples of resistance, even when they're very small minorities, is not a case of minimizing colonialist or racist thinking in the mainstream. I mean, take the example of Australia and the refugees at the moment. None of us would deny that Labour and the Liberals have won extraordinary and terrible victories over the last two decades in normalizing all sorts of forms of cruelty. We emphasize the resistance of the refugees and the possibility of struggle, not to try and undo that reality. You have to live with that reality and campaign around that reality, but rather to point to the fact that there is the possibility of an alternative. I think Said misses that. There's also in Said a flattening out of political economy. I mean, his book is called Culture and Imperialism, and yet it really has almost nothing to say about imperialism itself. It makes no distinction between settler colonial societies and imperialism more broadly. Why does that matter? I think it matters because it's in that specificity that we understand the connection between politics and culture, the way in which some of these struggles emerge. And it leaves us ill-placed in the second fifth of the 21st century to think about emerging patterns of inter-imperialist rivalry and workers' resistance to imperialism that don't fit inside the model set up by colonialism in the 19th century. I'm thinking particularly here about tensions between the United States and China, workers' resistance there, struggles on the Korean Peninsula, and so on and so forth. So to begin to sum up then, what to do with these criticisms and limitations? And part of what I did in this collection, Bashir Abumane's collection, was the the writer spent some time trying to tease out some of the limitations of Said's work and think about Said's work in that context. I stand by all of that, and I think it matters. And the article that I referred to in Marxist Left Review, I think matters there as well for drawing out the limitations of postcolonial theory. But I think, and this might be something that could get brought up in the debate and the discussion, in the context of 2021, we also need to be very cautious when we read materialist left-wing criticisms of Said that argue for a universalism to wonder what sort of universalism is being suggested. And I mean, in that context, the work, for example, of Vivek Chibba and the work of writers around Jacobin, where often the turn to the universalism at the level of theory, so against sort of postmodern and postcolonial theories, has also dovetailed or served a turn towards a kind of reformist downplaying of differences within the working class at the level of politics. Right? In that context, I think Said's absolute insistence on the pervasive racist imperial assumptions structuring US political culture remain absolutely vital. And I think the danger for us at the moment is much more the accommodations of left reformism than it is the kind of obfuscations of academic postcolonial literary theory, right? I think obscure writings existed in the academy for a long time. I don't think it has particular purchase on social movements in the way that this sort of broader shift towards the left reformism does at the moment. And so I think it's worth situating Said in this context, the insistence of the dissident intellectual, and thinking about to what end some of these criticisms is being deployed in the international debate. I want to end the introduction with another Darwish poem, actually, from the 1980s, from a period of some of the worst defeats of the Palestinian movement, that stands for me for so much of the value of Said, both in terms of what's been introduced into the Anglosphere, but also for the insistence it has here on Palestinian resistance and survival being a way towards a broader universalism. And the poem's called Earth Presses Against Us. Earth is pressing against us, trapping us in the final passage. To pass through, we pull off our limbs. Earth is squeezing us. If only we were its wheat, we might die and yet live. If only it were our mother so that she might temper us with mercy. If only we were pictures of rocks held in our dreams like mirrors. We glimpse faces in their final battle for the soul of those who will be killed by the last living amongst us. We mourn their children's feast. We saw the faces of those who would throw our children out of the windows of this last space, a star to burnish our mirrors. Where should we go after the last border? Where should birds fly after the last sky? Where should plants sleep after the last breath of air? We write our names with crimson mist. We end the hymn with our flesh. Here we will die. Here in the final passage, here or there, our blood will plant olive trees. And that line of Darwish is where should we go after the last border, I think, is a good place to end, because it underlines for us in a moment of what seemed from the outside like absolute defeat, 1967, Said found in the discovery of Palestinian movements from below the need for self-activity, the need for reliance on popular mobilization, a voice and a place for himself as an intellectual and as someone trying to place Palestinian existence at the center of a discussion that had been missing to officially to from here, a real source of hope at a moment when we're seeing some very dark days of counter-revolution and a number of the struggles that we wish to solidarize with. So I'll leave it there, Ben. Thank you.